Hey, this is John Lee Dumas from EO Fire, and you're listening to Elective Rotation with Pharmacy Joe. You must be prepared to ignite.
What's up, Pharmacy Nation? I'm Pharmacy Joe. Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care hospital pharmacy podcast. This is episode 8, a review of empiric antibiotic selection in the adult medical ICU. Rather than read out names of bugs over and over, I have all the relevant guidelines linked up for you in the show notes. So please check them out at pharmacyjoe.com/episode 8. So much of antibiotic selection has to do with local resistance patterns, and it cannot be protocolized or generalized without that knowledge. That said, I believe there are some principles of antibiotic selection in the ICU that are worth discussing in general terms. I'd like to give a big shout out to pharmacist Sokak and physician Mary for suggesting this topic. If you would like to suggest a topic for the show, please give me an email, joe@pharmacyjoe.com. Today, we will talk about 4 points. Number one, source identification and control. Number two, knowing antibiotic spectrum of activity. Number three, selecting empiric therapy against likely pathogens. Number four, a quick word on renal dose adjustment of initial empiric therapy. So first, source identification and control. Source identification is generally taken care of by my docs, and it is very rare that I find myself adding to the care of the patient in this area. The easy things that I look for are blood cultures, a positive urinalysis. I'm really focusing on the amount of whites in the urine. I'd like there to be greater than 20 whites per high-powered field. Chest x-ray, looking for an infiltrate. Obviously, I'm not looking for the infiltrate. I don't know about you. I'm not really good at reading chest x-rays. It's all black and white and gray mixed in there for me. So I'm going to rely either on the radiologist view or what the doc I'm next to is telling me. And then the physical exam, which again, I'm not really doing, but you know, the patient's belly, a skin wound, etc. This brings me to one of my favorite quotes by a former chief medical officer at my hospital, and that was, "Cold steel and the light of day cured many a disease." And this is just to say how important source control is. Your antibiotics aren't going to do much if source control is not obtained. So you want to make sure you know the patient management priority. And if source control cannot be achieved due to a problem that you can help fix, such as the patient being unstable, then focus on that so that you can get source control done for your infected patient. Another one of these quotes, I've used this before, I can't remember where I got it, and that is, you can blow your nose and clean your glasses with the same tissue, but you better do it in the right order. And now we're talking about blood cultures prior to antibiotics. I advocate for this, but make sure you don't withhold antibiotics if it looks like blood cultures will not be readily obtained. The surviving sepsis guidelines recommend no more than a 45-minute delay in antibiotics for the purpose of obtaining blood cultures first. That seems a little bit long. I never stretch it that far. The rare case where you could run into trouble here, and this has happened at my hospital once before, and that would be giving antibiotics prior to cultures in a patient that turns out to have endocarditis. If their cultures come back negative because of this, getting the antibiotic prior to cultures, then they might need 6 weeks of broad-spectrum therapy. Certainly not something you would wish on anyone. I think the one time this did happen was, very idiosyncratic. It was a pneumonia patient that just turned out to have endocarditis as well. Now, I've linked up a very nice video for you in the show notes. It's really going to help you remember what to look for as far as source identification. It's some folks at Kern Medical Center, and they've got a great YouTube video about sepsis called Sepsi Back. Check that out in the show notes, pharmacyjoe.com/episode 8. Now, moving on, knowing the spectrum of activity. The way I like to learn my spectrum of activity is, first I'll learn the rules, and then I'll learn the exceptions to the rules. And that's when it comes to knowing what drugs cover what bugs. So this section I'm about to go into will not be comprehensive. It's going to focus on classes of antibiotics that are likely to be used as empiric therapy. Again, I'm coming from the point of view of a 20-bed community hospital, mixed medical surgical ICU. I will also assume that you'll get info on dosing, mechanism of action, et cetera, elsewhere. For that, I suggest Johns Hopkins Antibiotic Guide. That's my personal favorite. I've got that linked up in the show notes. It has no pediatric dosing, so if that is more what you're looking for, then I suggest the Sanford Guide. But again, this information is not specific to peds. So let's talk about MRSA first. MRSA is covered by vancomycin, linezolid, daptomycin, and ceftaroline. That's the rule. The exceptions, daptomycin is inactivated by lung surfactant. Don't use it in pneumonia. Linezolid is bacteriostatic, so I don't use that in bloodstream infections. And then I remember ceftaroline as vancomycin and ceftriaxone rolled up into one lovable fuzzball. Let's move on to the next rule. Piperacillin tazobactam and the carbapenems, ertapenem, meropenem, doripenem, and imipenem all cover gram-positives, gram-negatives, and anaerobes. The exceptions to the rule, ertapenem doesn't cover Pseudomonas, and piperacillin tazobactam doesn't cover ESBL. Moving on to cephalosporins, I narrow these down to four that will probably be considered for empiric use in the ICU, and those four are cefepime, ceftriaxone, ceftazidime, and ceftaroline. These all cover gram-positives, gram-negatives. The exceptions, only cefepime and ceftazidime cover Pseudomonas, and none of them will cover enterococcus well. Now remember, enterococcus shows up on your gram stain as gram-positive cocci resembling strep. So keep that in mind if you have a source that matches up with possible enterococcus. You may not be going for a cephalosporin as your first line. The quinolones, ciprofloxacin, levofloxacin, and moxifloxacin, they cover gram-positives and gram-negatives. Please double-check your local resistance patterns. They are not very good for E. coli at my institution. I assume it's the same at yours. The exceptions to the rule, ciprofloxacin is weak against strep pneumo, but it causes the least amount of QTC prolongation and probably doesn't cause torsades. Moxifloxacin is best against anaerobes, but it has no Pseudomonas coverage. And moxifloxacin is hepatically metabolized. This is a double-edged sword. It has no dose adjustment in renal failure, which is fantastic, but you're not going to be using it for UTI. Now, we'll move on to selecting empiric therapy against likely pathogens. That brings me to my next favorite quote, you need a cillin to do the killin'. Whenever possible, I am looking for the strongest, most bactericidal antibiotic that I can give as empiric therapy. For lung infections, for a community-acquired infection, I'm going to be choosing ceftriaxone plus azithromycin or levofloxacin or moxifloxacin plus ceftriaxone. If it's a hospital infection, it's going to be vancomycin plus either piperacillin tazobactam or cefepime. And if it's an aspiration, then I'm going to add anaerobic coverage. The relevant guidelines are from IDSA for community-acquired pneumonia, hospital-acquired pneumonia, and I have those linked up in the show notes. If the site is the brain, for a community infection, the likely pathogens are going to differ by age group. You're going to be using vancomycin, ceftriaxone, and you're going to be adding ampicillin if the patient is over 50 years of age. If the patient is hospital-acquired or immune-compromised, then I'm going to be looking at vancomycin plus cefepime plus ampicillin as my initial therapy. Again, the guidelines are linked up from IDSA. Necrotizing fasciitis, this is a surgical emergency. Absolutely don't do anything that will delay the patient's transportation to the OR. The pathogens here are going to be group A strep, anaerobes, MRSA, the occasional gram negative. you can use linezolid plus piperacillin tazobactam or vancomycin plus piperacillin tazobactam plus clindamycin. Clindamycin or linezolid should be part of every regimen for neck fash until group A strep is ruled out. But remember, their purpose is not to kill the strep. They're bacteriostatic. Their purpose is to shut down toxin production. And again, relevant guidelines are linked up in the show notes. As far as belly as a source, you're going to need to hit gram negatives as well as anaerobes. You'll be using piperacillin tazobactam or one of the carbapenems. I don't use ertapenem in the ICU though, so that leaves meropenem, imipenem, doripenem. A community-acquired infection shouldn't need empiric antifungal therapy. Nosocomial infections may. More is discussed in the IDSA guidelines that I have linked up here. If you have a critically ill patient with Candida isolated, you want to be using micafungin until you know that fluconazole will be okay. Now we're going to touch on unknown source. That's going to be vancomycin plus piperacillin tazobactam or cefepime or meropenem. The sicker the patient, the broader the coverage. Combination therapy, your local resistance patterns are going to dictate whether you use combination therapy and when. The surviving sepsis guidelines do recommend as a level 2B evidence empiric double coverage against Pseudomonas in neutropenic patients for 3 to 5 days unless you can narrow treatment sooner based on cultures. Other bugs, once identified, also have 2B recommendation for double coverage. That's Pseudomonas and Strep pneumo. Your antibiogram should determine whether your second agent for Pseudomonas is a quinolone or an aminoglycoside. And quickly, we'll end on renal dose adjustment of empiric antibiotic therapy. Remember, there are two reasons to adjust the medication for renal insufficiency. It's either to prevent toxicity or to save money. There'll be plenty of opportunity to reduce drug costs if the patient survives. So for this reason, if I'm using a relatively non-toxic antibiotic, think anything with a beta-lactam ring, I will dose as per the patient's baseline renal function for the first 24 hours and then reassess the dose after that. The serum creatinine is going to lag actual improvement in kidney function, and a Cockcroft gout was studied in mostly 50 and 60-year-olds who all had stable renal function. That's it for the show today. If you would like a copy of my visual antibiotic guide, if you haven't gotten that yet, please head on over to the show notes and you can get it for free. That's pharmacyjoe.com/episode8. If you'd like to share anything on today's topic, or if you have an idea for the show, please let me know by sending me an email to joe@pharmacyjoe.com. And please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher. Doing so will help others find the show. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.